welcome back to Tab U. My name's Katrina, and today we're back in the studio, and I'm joined by Ellie Corman. Welcome.
Hello, thank you.
And our special guest, Joe Griffin from London Penthouse. Welcome.
Thank you.
Would you like to give a little bit of an intro to who you are, what you do?
Yeah, my name's Joe Griffin. We have a company called London Penthouse, which specialises in airspace development.
As you guessed it, listeners, our topic today is on airspace development. So we'll kick things off with question number one. Quite simply, what is airspace development?
So to us, airspace development is building on top of existing buildings to put new levels of accommodation, so new apartments, penthouses, depending on the building. So there can be residential buildings, commercial buildings. It's basically taking what was an unused space above an existing building and creating new residential apartments.
How does it work? How do you find the space? Like, is it literally, well, as the term suggests, it's, is there anything there before?
No, it's just the flat roof of an existing apartment block. And we'd find them by sometimes just literally walking around and looking up in the air and thinking that that building could take an additional level.
Does it have to be a flat roof?
8 out of 10, I would say, are the buildings that we develop on our flat roof. It makes it a lot easier.
Yeah.
But we can convert the pitch roof of buildings as well.
So if someone owns a building, do they own the airspace above that building?
The freeholder would own the airspace above the building. So depending on the ownership structure of the building, whether you have a standalone freeholder or you have so a number of leaseholders that all have a share of the freehold, the freehold company or the share of freeholders will own the freehold, will own the airspace of the building.
And when you kind of buy this airspace to then develop, are you buying the right to build, or that actually, or are you just buying that kind of, I don't know, 200 metres above 100 metres or whatever the top of the building
is? So we would normally buy a lease of the airspace. So it'd be like anything from the roof to the clouds would then be under our ownership. Or we could do a joint venture with a freeholder whereby there'd be a development agreement in place to say that for example, for a set premium or for a set consideration, that we would have the building rights to develop, and then we would split the asset come the end of the project. So it could be one of two ways, really. We'd either purchase a lease of the airspace or have an agreement with the freeholder where we'd basically be a joint venture of sorts to develop.
I think we'll go into that later on, into kind of a little bit of the actual detail there. But when it comes to kind of funding airspace developments, and is it similar to normal property developments? Is it a bit more challenging? What are the considerations you need to think about when trying to get finance?
I'm sure Ellie could expand on this, but I'm sure we'd both agree that it's primarily about experience. It is logistically more challenging building on top of occupied dwellings. But if you, as we have a track record, which Ellie's aware of. Obviously, we are currently doing projects together with you guys, which has been great. But it's experience, I think, is key for lenders. Is what I have been led to believe.
Yeah, from our perspective, for any development, experience is really key. But
yeah.
I think, as you said, Joe, when it comes to airspace, with the complexities of dealing with other people in the building, and again, Katrina, as you said, we're going to go into a bit more detail on that, it's really important to know that the developer has done that before, has got out successfully. And successfully doesn't mean just turning a profit, but success also means keeping everyone happy, producing a good product that everyone's proud of in that new building.
Yeah.
Cool. Kind of leads us into kind of question number two, which is, how do you keep all parties happy? You mentioned that it can be difficult building on something with dwellings in. Let's say you've got a property, it's got tenants or residents. How does that relationship work?
So you have, if we go back to thinking about the ownership structure, so if you have a you have a building, so we have 10 apartments in each in that building, the airspace will have a value. If the ownership structure is each one of those 10 apartments, existing apartments, has a share of the freehold, then the premium that we would pay for the airspace and the development rights would automatically go to the leaseholders, because they would all have a share of the freehold. So they would, the leaseholders in that instance would be consenting to the our proposals.
Mm-hmm.
So that's sort of, that box is ticked, if you like, for how do we keep people on board in that instance.
What happens, Joe, if 8 are on board and 2 are not really interested? How does that work?
Again, it all depends on the voting structure of and the articles of how the freehold company has been set up. Normally, it's a majority a majority vote on in those instances. But each development that we have done, whereby you have the ownership structure set up, that each leaseholder has a share of the freehold, because it's such a big decision, the freehold company would normally insist that it's a unanimous vote in favour, or the project doesn't go ahead.
And in the scenario where there's a freeholder, and I guess tenants, what happens there?
So, again, it's our offer then would go to the freeholder, and it is. It's normally the freeholder's responsibility to ensure that the leaseholders are suitably recompensed or compensated for the nine to 12 months that we're actually going to be on site. But there are things that we actually do as a company ourselves, and we would, on every development, we would commit a pot of money to overhaul the existing common areas of the building, which will have a positive impact on
the tenants.
The tenants, and there is also historically we found that by adding penthouses or top floor apartments to existing buildings and overhauling the common areas, the grounds, it automatically has a positive impact on the market value of the existing apartments within the block.
Would you say that once you've agreed your deal with the leaseholders or the freeholder, and they've taken money off the table effectively for the purchase of the rights that you have now to build those 4 or 8 apartments, whatever it may be, they then quickly forget about that, and sort of 6 months into a build where it's noisy, it's disturbing, it's dusty, the scaffolding's there, it's, you know, it's gone through winter and snow and there's lots of mud around. Do you find they forget about the fact that they're now technically partners with you and want more from you?
Not necessarily. I mean, it's all about communication. Me personally, I regularly hold tenants meetings. We do normally once a month, but if it requires more frequently than that, I will always go and meet with the tenants, and if there's any concerns, they're addressed straight away. People just like to know what's going on, and to have someone to, in some instances, vent to.
Mm-hmm.
But the overriding thing is that, look, we appreciate and we know that we are the unwanted guest that's come to stay for 9 to 12 months, and people would like us as out the door as quickly as possible. So in terms of leaseholders or people being obstructive, the initial 2 to 3 weeks, it's new, and there can be some angst people about, but it's, look, we, as I say, we let people voice their concerns and try and mitigate as much as we can.
I think from a lender's perspective, that's actually really important. We talked before about experience and success.
Yeah.
Knowing that you can get through a project, knowing that the developer can get through a project with happy tenants at the end of the day,
yeah,
means it'll be a speedy project, which mm-hmm. is what all lenders want. They want to have a smooth, easy process from start to finish. It doesn't always happen. But knowing that you're not going to be stuck with delays because tenants are kicking up a fuss on everything along the 12 months, which can turn into 18 or 24, means it's a successful development and one developer we would want to back.
It's when you think about it logically as well, it's that if there's a scaffold up on a block for 9 to 12 months, it's in everyone's interests are aligned. They want we want to be off site as quickly as possible. We do, because it's all about throughput and turnover for us as a business. But the leaseholders that we're building on top of, they also want us out the door mm-hmm. as quickly as possible. So we are aligned. So a bit once we're established on site and we get a rapport with people, they understand that we're there,
yeah.
And we want to make it as pain free as possible for everyone. So we don't really get a lot of obstructions, should we say.
I guess in this case, you are swallowing the cost of developing or refurbishing the internal areas. What is the alternative? And I'm kind of leading into this Section 20 thing that I previously heard. Is that something you guys do? Or is that something other people do? And yeah, I guess add a little flavour to what it is.
So Section 20 is the... obviously, they're works that are required to a building.
Mm-hmm.
They would be required whether we was carrying out a rooftop development or not. They're in, as I say, works that are required come what may. For example, we're working on a project at the minute that it needed a full new roof. Best part of a couple of hundred grand to replace a roof. By the lease that the freeholder selling us the airspace and the rights to develop,
yeah,
that cost is no longer required to replace the roof, because we would do that as a matter of course anyway.
Yeah.
So there is there's a genuine 200 grand saving going to the leaseholders of the block.
And I guess had you not gone in and been working on the project, would they have had to take the cost of the roof?
Exactly.
Has that happened more than one occasion where you've noticed like, oh, actually you're going to be need, you would have, if we weren't here, you would have needed to have do all of this.
Yeah.
Is it usually roofs?
it's roofs. It's, there's, say, common staircases.
Yeah.
A lot of buildings are seriously lacking with fire regulations at the minute. So by us putting on a new story of accommodation, we have to overhaul and upgrade all the fire alarms, the common lobbies from roof to ground floor level. So we upgrade all the existing flat entrance doors, for example. Again, it's a cost that we absorb as part of the development, but is obviously a genuine benefit to.
Maybe you
to
could come
holders.
Check out my house, see if there's any cost savings I can make. if we kind of move on to question number three, which is what is the design process of an airspace?
Yeah.
Where do you start? Do you have to match styles? Mm. You obviously mentioned you're upgrading internal fire systems, everything like that. Who does that?
So we'd have from the beginning, you need to get planning. So we would never buy, or I'll say never say never, but when we purchase an airspace, it's 9 times out of 10 it's subject to planning. So the first step would be to obtain planning consent. So you'd have your architect on board, and depending on the council, and depending on whether you're in a conservation area or not, it all depends on how much flair you can have with your design. Some boroughs and conservation areas, they don't like to see a lot of change don't like to see anything too wacky, shall we say, or even they just like things just to blend in.
Mm-hmm.
But then other areas, a project in Highgate that Ellie's familiar with, which is a conservation area, we built something that was very contemporary on top of a building, on top of a 1930s building, where you'd thought that the council would require something a lot more traditional, say.
Mm-hmm.
So it all depends on who your target audience is, really, from a design point of view.
Mm-hmm.
Aesthetically.
What about structurally?
Structurally, we would, before we even go in for planning, we would, again, this is something where a lot of people do actually fall down with airspace development. They would go in for planning for, right, okay, that building can, from a planning point of view, can take two stories. But structurally, the building's never going to mm-hmm. take two stories. So we would get a structural report done, like a feasibility report done on the building and its structural integrity and the likelihood of it taking an additional story, story and a half, two stories. And that is how we then set our brief to our architects and planning mm-hmm. consultants.
How do the engineers do that with tenants still there? So it's very easy if you have a building that is going to come down, so you can start to do your trial pits or take things apart. But when you have leaseholders, tenants in the buildings that don't want anything touched, how does the engineer really get to understand what the building can cope with?
So historical ground reports. Again, this is where we differ from others. A lot of the buildings that we look at will comfortably take one additional lightweight story.
Mm-hmm.
And the structural engineers can work that out by the existing mass. There is a formula that they use without even having to do intrusive exploratory works to the existing structure of the building. So rather than upset the apple cart and upset leaseholders, we mm-hmm. tend to go for the lowest hanging fruit, as it were. So one story is plenty for us, and we will adjust, we'll sort of table our offer around what we know that we can get a consent, well, one, a consent for, but two, what the building will feasibly take from a structural point of view without having to disrupt leaseholders.
And keeping them happy at the same time.
Exactly, yeah.
And you kind of, you've obviously got to connect your new airspace to the building below. Is it as simple as a staircase? Are you having to get lift extension? Is it a lift extension?
Yeah.
I wouldn't even know what else. Ladders?
Electrics, plumbing.
Trampolines.
How do you plug everything in on another level?
So again, it's new services through mm-hmm. the existing risers and common staircases. You have to have a common staircase which goes up to the existing top floor level to be able to extend it up to break through the existing roof and onto the new level. Sometimes where you have duplex apartments, the staircase finishes a level below, and that renders the scheme non-deliverable.
Because you'd have to then put a staircase into
an external staircase. Yeah. Or it's
I don't think you can sell a penthouse and have at the entrance as a ladder. But
keep the scaffold up on a pulley wheel.
Yeah, perfect. I'll buy it. I can afford that one, maybe. So just redoing everything then, and then. Modular builds, heard of that? Is that something you do? Is it something you're supportive of? Pros and cons? Do you do modular build? Start with that question.
It's something that we've explored extensively. For me, it's we do a bit of a hybrid. Which is, we have the structure can be delivered delivered to site in a panelled format. So we can keep the structural element, the main construction element on site, the time frame down to a minimum. Mm-hmm. But me personally, I'm not saying that there's anything wrong with modular, but I'm yet to see the quality of having an apartment delivered to site, painted, grouted, kitchens in, plates in the cupboards.
So it's kind of so modular build is, as far as I'm aware, you've almost pre-built it off-site and then it's just sticking
the whole
top.
Flat is built in a factory.
How does that? That's incredible.
It is incredible. But I mean, they call it modular.
Yeah.
But they come in set size pods. Again, if you're going in for planning, you should be going in for planning with modular in mind.
Mm-hmm.
Bear in mind, we're buying rooftops that are already there. So we have to fit our design and our construction to the footprint of the existing building. That can be difficult if you've got different shapes and sizes with modular.
Mm-hmm.
And it can be not as economical to build.
Yeah.
And so you touched on design. Do you find that do you find that the design of a rooftop airspace development is more complex, and I'm talking about the internal design, than a usual development?
It's, again, depending on the services below, we like to try and keep everything, because you're connecting into existing services. So it can dictate where the existing services run within the building, like your drainage, etc. It can dictate where you would house your bathrooms, for example, or your kitchens, just so your waste runs, etc., in your services voids are not too long. You've got enough fall, etc. Mm-hmm. All technical points.
maybe that's another podcast.
It's good just to touch
on the technical points.
I guess if we actually kind of move on to question number four, what are the steps to the construction process of airspace development? And I guess this the actual construction side of it. We've mentioned kind of planning and how you get that. But where do you start with the construction?
So the construction starts for us before we've even got the sign-off of the planning. We are thinking, how are we going to deliver this project? Again, it's even before we go in for planning, mm-hmm. we've made an assessment to say, right, okay, this project is deliverable. It's deliverable without upsetting people. It's reputational damage is something that we are seriously focused on. It takes years to make a good name for yourself, and it'll take 10 minutes to lose it.
Mm-hmm.
So before we even go in for planning, we're thinking about the construction steps of each individual project in its own merits. But you have a pre-construction phase, which where we'll, again, the same with any development, really, we'll discharge our pre-commencement conditions. So a lot of the boroughs that we're working in now, we have construction management plans that mm-hmm. we have to adhere to. Kensington and Chelsea, for example, now they're very, it's been quite refreshing actually seeing how they put so much onus on making sure that you're not upsetting people, your hours of working, your delivery times that you've got to adhere to.
Does that also include, I mean, the kind of where you, I've seen a lot of fake pictures of buildings on the scaffolding to kind of make it look not as garish when their building's being built. Are those sort of things considered as well?
Yeah.
In this stage?
When the budget allows.
Yeah.
Because
yeah.
they are incredibly expensive. I know what you mean. But yeah, just a good, clean, strong site setup.
Yeah.
And yeah, we're just trying to keep just try and keep disruption to a minimum. We have our own in-house construction team. We're part of the Considerate Constructors. What's the word I'm looking for?
Scheme.
It's something that is incredibly important. You get planning on the site, yep. but you don't realize you can't sell them unless you build them properly.
Can I just ask how party wall awards fit into all that as well? Yeah. Because that's also one of the pre-construction phases that you need to go through on any site. Does that differ?
And what is a party wall?
Yes.
Through the whole
party wall awards.
So party wall award has been changing, but it's generally the a notice that's served on adjoining property owners to, if you're carrying out any structural works or bearing load onto the party wall between your new property and an existing property. Now, if you think about it, we are not building next to someone, we're building mm-hmm. on top of someone. So the actual roof, itself, is a party structure. Mm-hmm. The external envelope of the building is not. That is part of the freehold. So your building envelope, for example, doesn't require a party wall award to be served or a party wall notice to be served.
So you don't get party ceilings.
No. But if you are bearing load down on internal spine walls, then you will need a party structure. Or if you're cutting into the structure of the roof itself, a party wall notice and a party wall award will be required.
So would that kind of be if you were adding or extending the staircase?
No, that won't be a requirement because it's part of the common area. And how we're sort of approaching schemes at the minute is if the structure can be designed in a way to mitigate the need for party wall mm-hmm. awards, that's the route that we're tending to go down.
And I guess when you're in mid construction, laid your first brick. Where do you store the rest of them? Are they on the ground? Are they on the roof? How does it work if you've not got?
We tend, with building on top of existing dwellings, we're used to building on sort of postage stamp sites, really. So the way that we manage the construction process through our site managers and gang of men and what have you, and office staff is we order enough to be getting on. So mm-hmm. it's a little and often approach where we don't need to stockpile huge amounts of material. Again, because it's an eyesore. It could be an eyesore for leaseholders, and we try and not take up too much of the common grounds of the freehold that we're building on top of.
Do you find that doing that makes a development take longer than it should do normally?
Not if the site managers are doing their job properly.
Yes, as
so,
expected.
So yes is the answer.
Moving on to question number 5, which is how do the sales and marketing of airspace differ from other types of development? Are you selling, is this considered a new build?
Yes, it is.
There we go. Is it normal route? Are you building often building one penthouse or several? Varies, I guess.
Again, all depends on the size of the building. We've built one, two at a time. We're actually into a scheme at the minute where we're hoping to achieve 17 on a roof.
That's cool.
So it does vary, but our sweet spot, if you like, I don't like saying things like that, but our sweet spot, if you like, is say anywhere between 2 and 10 units. Because
mm-hmm.
If you think we very rarely build more than one story, have a big old roof to get 10 units up there.
What's the most stories you have built?
Two.
What's the most unit? 17.
That will be the largest single scheme, yeah.
And do you ever keep them to rent out personally?
Yeah, we do.
Well,
yeah.
As a business, I guess.
Yeah, we do. It all depends on what the market's doing at the time you come to sell. As I'm sure Ellie will tell you, it's peaks and troughs and it fluctuates.
And are there many other developers doing specific to airspace, or is it
not as well as us?
And remind us who you are, London Penthouse. And what is the most exciting airspace project you've done?
They are all exciting for different reasons. We're currently looking at one. Also, we've currently agreed a deal with one at the minute in Kensington, which is a fantastic building. It'd be a great deal for us. Great area.
Yeah.
Watch your space.
I thought you were going to say the one in Highgate.
I think that's a really great project. Yeah, that was a great project.
And obviously the one in Acton that we're working on currently.
Yeah, they're all as they all have their merits. One in Highgate, that's where Ellie and I first met on a roof.
How romantic.
10 years ago.
Yeah.
And where can people find you?
We're based in Winchmore Hill in North London, but if you look up when you're in traffic, you'll probably see me hanging off a roof somewhere in London.
Head up there and you can meet you for the first time as well. Then.
Yeah.
great. Any more questions?
No. And your website?
And the website is www.londonpenthouse.com.
Perfect. I will also include it in all show notes so people can find you there as well.
And the Instagram is?
Go on.
At London Penthouse. There you go.
Perfect.
I've just been told.
We'll tag you as well.
Thank you.
Thank you very much for watching. This has been Tab U. And thank you, Ellie, for coming back on. And thank you, Joe.
Thank you very much for having me.
See you next time. Don't forget to like, share, subscribe, comment. Bye-bye.